طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح، طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's brutal occupation and colonization of their homeland. The purpose of This Week in Palestine is to feature the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian voice, that is too often missing in the presentation of news and analysis in the American mainstream media. This is your host, John Roberts. Well, we have a real treat for you this morning. Old friend Mazen Kumsia was in town from Bethlehem in the West Bank of Palestine this week and gave one of his amazing, broad-ranging, totally integrated presentations at the Community Church of Boston. We first got to know Mazen when he was still teaching genetics at Yale University and was active with us politically in all the Palestinian rights issues. He subsequently has returned to his native Palestine, where he teaches at Bethlehem University, and has founded there the Palestine Natural History Museum. This is a full presentation, so we have to get right to it. Here is Mazen Kumsia, as introduced by one of his former interns at the museum, Annabel Roby.
I would like to now introduce Annabel Roby, who is going to introduce Mazen. And Annabel is a member of Jewish Voice for Peace and was an intern at the Palestine Museum of Natural History, where she worked with Mazen. Annabel?
I decided to volunteer at the Palestine Museum of Natural History because I wanted to learn and I wanted to support the liberation of Palestinian people. And unexpectedly, I spent most of my time at the museum collecting snails. To Mazen, collecting snails is an integral part of Palestinian liberation. Most people have heard the phrase, existence is resistance, in this room, I imagine. Well, Mazen's museum and the community he's built there is the perfect example of that phrase. Yeah, absolutely. He would always say to us, we exist, the plants exist, the bees exist, the snails exist. So you walk into the grounds of the museum and it is this complete haven teeming with plant and animal life, full of art and a diverse team of people who work there who are passionate about what they do and progressively minded. Anyone could justifiably use the occupation as a reason to not think about the effects of climate change and the environment, but Mazen and his team refuse to ignore it. We don't have time to ignore it, they say. In doing so, he's inspiring his community to take care of the land and remember why they love it so much, which fuels them to keep fighting for the fight for liberation. It's amazing. I don't know how many people here know Mazen, but it's amazing how he integrates all of his skills and passions into one cohesive project. So he's been collecting specimens since I think he was about seven, eight, and despite all the twists and turns his life has taken, he never gave up on opening the museum that he now runs. Something that really inspires me about him is he merges his science with his politics, because everything is political, which is something I wish more scientists around here would acknowledge. He somehow manages to do it all. On a given day, he'll be in a lab overseeing genetic experiments, then out in the field collecting specimens, snails, then speaking to a peace delegation about the history of the occupation, and then, to top it all off, make a mean ma'aluba for dinner. It was a true marvel to see him work, and an honor to work with him. I'm so excited to welcome him back to Boston and hear updates about what he's doing.
Thank you, everybody. Thanks for coming, and thanks for the organizers and also for the wonderful meal. Great food, so it's really an honor to be here and see all of you. Many of you I knew before, some new people. Those who haven't been to Palestine, you have to come. And we have an open house. We can host you, food and lodging on us. You come up with your tickets. Okay. What I want to do today is a bit different. First, I want to start by telling you what I'm not going to discuss. at least in the formal presentation, so to speak. But if you bring it up in the question and answer, I'm more than happy to discuss. I'm not going to discuss the U.S. Move of its embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. I'm not going to discuss Kim Jong-il, or whatever his name is, or what his future might be or might not be, whether it's like Saddam Hussein or Gaddafi or anything else. I'm not discussing the Iran nuclear deal and how grave a threat the Iranians pose to us, putting their country right in the middle of our bases over there. I'm not discussing Syria and what's happening in Syria, as important as that may be, another subject. But again, in the question and answer, I'm happy to deal with that. I'm not discussing this asshole. Sorry. I should start with the being nice. There's two of them, actually. There, but anyways, who are, of course, starving the people of Yemen and bombing Yemen. Last week, actually, we had demonstrations in Ramallah against the Palestinian Authority. I'm not discussing these guys, these characters, who actually dragged some of my friends away, and 32 of them are still in Palestinian jails. They were dressed as common people, but we know them as security, Palestinian security people. We can talk about Gaza a little bit. I will talk about Gaza. There were demonstrations in Jordan also. I don't know. This is just kind of rambling on the events in the past few weeks. Demonstrations in Jordan, both against what's happening in Gaza, but also against the government for obeying the IMF World Bank as a result of it being accumulating debt. Part of it to serve Israel, for example, the Red Sea, Dead Sea Canal, which costs $15 billion that the government of Jordan has ended up with a debt on. I am not going to discuss religions, even though I think I like this cartoon. Somebody sent it to me this morning, so I thought I'd put it up. It says, and I'm sorry, by the way, my angle here, you guys, somebody here is not going to see anything. Whoever might want to move and put a couple of chairs on this side. Or maybe I'll shrink myself a little bit. But anyway, Jesus was not a white man or a blue-eyed. Sorry to disappoint you. The economy is really worth a lecture of its own, of course. And the World Bank and the IMF, they usually put out figures like this that show the GDP, average GDP of a country, that Israel, for example, is this much, Saudi Arabia this much, etc. But that's average. Nobody makes that, actually. I don't know of any Saudi who makes $21,000 a year. They either make near zero or they make billions of dollars. This figure actually illustrates it. You won't see such figures in the World Bank data of income and disparity in those countries. I'm not going to discuss also why the economy is integral to war and peace in the Middle East. The fact that Gaza is being besieged has nothing to do with Hamas or any of that stuff. It has to do with these very rich gas fields that are off of Gaza that Israel wants to keep. This is the real reason for the besiege of Gaza and the preventing of Gaza people from going over 8 miles away from that. Now that I've told you what I'm not going to discuss in the formal presentation, what am I going to discuss? And this is a very good question. And thanks, Annabelle, for the introduction, which maybe is what I'll focus on, is how do we link nature, diversity of nature to diversity in human societies. That's what I want to focus on. And I'm actually writing articles about this. I may end up writing a book about it. I have two more books, by the way. There's two of my books over there, but I have two more books coming out later this year, and then hopefully next year I'll do a book on the issue of diversity in nature and diversity in human societies. Now, Palestine is a center of diversity. Because of its geographical location, because of its geological location, because of its history, because it's present between Eurasia and Africa, even birds had to migrate through Palestine. And certainly humans had to migrate through Palestine. So, you know, and I appreciate the acknowledgement from Elsa about the Native Americans here. Native Americans actually are Palestinians. And you guys are all Palestinians. Why? Because you passed from East Africa when you went out into the world. You passed through Palestine. Now, some of us stayed in Palestine, hung around. And some of us continued on, including what became the Native Americans as they crossed the Bering Strait and ended up in North America and South America some 12,000 years ago. So it is a very important location geographically, geologically, historically, religion even, but as I promised not to talk about religion, so let's leave that aside. But anyways, it's also where humans developed agriculture, domestication of animals and plants first started in our region. That's a fertile crescent where humans first domesticated things like wheat and barley and chickpeas, hummus. Most of you know hummus, of course. You don't have any Middle Eastern meal without hummus. And that's what the people looked like, by the way, our ancestors. Before they called themselves Canaanites, we don't know what they called themselves, but the archaeologists call it the Natufian agriculture after Wadi Natuf, which is in the northern part of Palestine. And this is a reconstruction of a skull of an ancestor, Canaanitic ancestor, whatever. I think they got everything correct except the color of the eye. But these are the Canaanites, as they are depicted in hieroglyphics and in Mesopotamian also. Culture, the people who had a rich land, part of this fertile crescent, who lived in relative harmony with nature, and who are just as indigenous as any other people on earth. These are just some of the pictures of these people. My grandfather actually dressed like the gentleman in the striped cloth there. And that's typical Canaanitic, by the way, dress. For the woman, these fancy embroidered clothes, etc. This is actually a picture of my grandmother on my father's side. And the only picture available of my grandmother as she was walking down the stairs from the old house. The Western Fertile Crescent is also, because that's where humans developed agriculture, that's also where, once we developed agriculture and stopped worrying about hunting and gathering, of course, we had time on our hand. So, I don't know, we waged wars. And we invented things like the alphabet and music and laws and maybe religions and other things. Okay, so the alphabet that you use here, for example, comes from us, by the way. I don't know if you know this. The A comes from the Aleph, which is the bull with the two horns. The B comes from Beit, which is a house, a line and a half circle. You put it on its side, you get the Latin B, and so on. Now, the conflict, I'm not going to spend too much time because many of you are already familiar with the history of the current conflict. But this is a passing moment in history, and it's not a very significant moment, by the way. I'm sorry to say this to, you know, for those of you who watch the news here, think that, hell, these Arabs and Jews have been fighting each other for thousands of years. And whatever. No, I'm sorry. It's a small conflict that started in the late 19th century. And before that, there was hardly any conflict. So you'd have to go back to the time of the Crusaders to find another conflict. And then you have to go back to 600 AD to find another conflict, and in between, relative peace, nothing happening. Boring, if you want. The media here loves blood and gore, so of course the media in the Middle East is focused. There is a conflict now, and we have to acknowledge there is a conflict, and you and I are unlucky enough to be living in this period of conflict. And it's like the Crusaders, it's not an indigenous conflict, didn't start among the people there, whether Jews, Christians, Muslims, or whoever was there. It started from Europe and came to us, just like the Crusaders. When the Crusaders came also, by the way, the Muslims, Christians, Jews were living in the Middle East very fine, no problems. And it's not true that the churches were controlled by the infidels. No, actually, my ancestors, who are Greek Orthodox, had control of the Church of Nativity, the Church of the Sepulchre. All the churches were under control of our ancestors, the Christians who lived there. So what is this conflict about? It's a very simple conflict. It's not very complicated to understand, by the way. Jews in Europe were discriminated against, and a majority of them resisted discrimination. A minority thought, well, let's go create our own thing somewhere. Blacks in America did the same thing, by the way. There were blacks discriminated against. Many of them resisted discrimination. People like Martin Luther King, Malcolm X, Edwin Douglas, many others. But there were a few minority blacks who said, heck with it, you can't live with these white people. They have a gene to discriminate against us. So let us go create our own thing. And they did. You know the country they went and created in Africa, called Liberia, for liberty, for freedom. Of course, the problem for them, Liberia was not a land without a people for a people without a land. To this day, there's a conflict between the colonizers, the American blacks, and the native people of that country. Same thing with this guy and Herzl and the people around him who created Zionism and developed it in the late 19th century. They realized that Palestine was full of people. 97% of the population was not Jewish. And how are you going to take a country that's multi-ethnic, multicultural, multi-religious, called Palestine, and recreate it as a Jewish state of Israel? It's a problem, a conundrum that they had to face. And the answer was obvious. The native people had to go. And this was said by just about every one of them, like Ben-Gurion, like Moshe Shavit, Golda Meir, others, they said the same thing. I'm going to cut now a little bit of this history because you all know it. You know that the French and the British, for example, issued declarations in support of the Zionist project, the Balfour Declaration and the Jules Cambon declarations, and it was during the First World War, and partly because the Allies wanted the Zionists to help them bring the United States into the war, which they succeeded, by the way. but the bottom line is we Palestinians had to go. And 500 and plus Palestinian villages and towns, which are shown in the red dots on this map, were wiped out. And today, 7.5 million of us are refugees or displaced people. And Israel was created on 78% of Palestine and took on the other 22% of Palestine, which is the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, and proceeded to repeat the process of ethnic cleansing, pushing people out and taking over and creating these settlements like you see here around my town of Bethlehem, and squeezing the Palestinians into smaller and smaller areas. And we Palestinians ended up in about 8.3% of the land, which is worse than what happened in South Africa. In South Africa, it was 11.5% of the land that was dedicated to the black community. The shrinking land of Palestine is the same as what happened in North America. In fact, the idea of a shrinking map of Palestine came to my son when he was 13 years old. And he developed this shrinking map of Palestine, which you may have seen before. And it came to him because he saw the shrinking map of the United States, which you see at the bottom. This is colonization, and colonization is not a nice word now, but it was a common word. It was used by all the early Zionists, from Herzl to Ben-Gurion, everybody else, Jabotinsky, etc. Colonization have certain characteristics that are very well familiar to you all, and I don't have to go through them. They have certain symptoms that we don't have to go through them, including how the colonizers perceive themselves and how the native people perceive themselves. Okay, if this is the case, let me step back on here. What is, so this is kind of all introduction. I told you what I'm not going to tell you, and then I told you. Sorry. But then I told you the main thing is colonization. Now what? We can sit here and lament and say, you know, God bless the Palestinians, they are like Native Americans, and maybe soon they'll be selling us embroidered stuff, and maybe soon we will be making speeches about them like what we heard earlier. Or we can say there's something different, or that the world can be different, or that we can envision a better world, or that we can do something about it. And I can tell you, actually, in our case, I'm very optimistic. Of course, when I was in the U.S., I even participated in demonstrations, and with Native Americans, etc. And I don't give up on Native Americans, but Palestinians have a much better chance. Why? If I'm in the medical genetics field, and I say you look at other patients, and you look at the current patient, and the strength of that current patient, maybe his age, his physique, his whether he has other conditions or whatever, and based on that you can make what we call a prognosis, right? So we had the patient history, you heard about it. Diagnosis is colonialism. What's a prognosis? Well, colonialism, there's only one of three possible outcomes. There's the Algerian model. I don't need to tell you about that, you know it. There is the Australia and US model. I don't need to tell you about those. Genocide, basically. And there is the rest of the world model. Those first two models, by the way, are very rare. You find them in very few countries. The rest of the world model is clear in South America, Central America, Caribbean islands, Mexico, Canada, Brazil, Argentina, Southeast Asia like Malaysia, Indonesia, Philippines, Taiwan, South Africa most recently. What's in those situations? People just live together. They even marry each other, by the way. And you cannot even tell now a Mexican person whether he's an illegal of an ancestry of Spanish or an illegal of an ancestry of Native, according to Trump. But anyways, this is the reality, this is the outcomes. Which outcome do you prefer? Which outcome do we prefer? I think it's very obvious, most of us prefer the third outcome. And just based on probability basis, that's what's going to happen, right? And that's part of my optimism. The other part of my optimism, which is a major part of my talk, is about the fact that in nature, diverse ecosystems are longer lasting, are healthier ecosystems than ecosystems dominated by one species. Okay? And this is an important feature to realize, by the way. The same for human societies. By the way, when Israel demolished those 500 plus Palestinian villages and towns, including uprooting all their trees like figs and almonds and olives and carob trees, etc., what did they plant instead of these? They planted European pine trees. It's almost metaphorical, by the way. Monoculture. So monoculture was very unstable. And today, when you hear about fires in the Galilee, which now they call northern Israel, which I don't recognize, by the way, it's northern Palestine, but that's another story. Monoculture is not healthy, okay? An ecosystem that is diverse is more healthy. whether in plants, whether in animals, also in humans. So when we talk about diversity of human societies, we talk about a strong society that is continuously evolving, by the way, and doesn't mean that it's static. The reverse, actually. Every society that is diverse continuously recreates itself. This is a part of the reason why we say about people who want to kind of reclaim the past, make America great again, so to speak. What is the notion of that? That's like going back, you know, you cannot recreate history. You know, yes, America was mostly white at some point, but you cannot recreate history. I'm sorry, history is past. It's gone. So you have to recognize that these societies evolve, and a diverse society like the United States evolved and moved on. And now we have people of various backgrounds, including people like me, whether you like it or not. I'm a U.S. citizen, okay? So, and by the way, just for the record, my father is Greek Orthodox, my mother is Lutheran, my wife is Chinese American, my son was born in Lubbock, Texas, so he's a redneck atheist. My sister went to Utah and became a Mormon, God bless her soul. I have cousins who became Muslims, and it's wonderful. It's a wonderful life, okay? For the life of me, by the way, I never understood people who want to be just with people just like themselves, you know? It's sick, it's boring. Why would I want to be with people just like me? I don't even stand myself sometimes. So it is natural to have diversity, to have these variations of ideologies, of religions, of backgrounds, etc. And Palestine, by the way, was like that. Even North America was like that, by the way, for hundreds of years, thousands of years. Native Americans were not one religion or one language or one this or one that. They were diverse. So we are diverse, and diversity is strength, and diversity is what will come back again in vengeance, by the way, in the world, I assure you. And people like Trump will be looked at in 100 years with ridicule, like how could this have happened? Already they are doing that, but ridiculing him. This woman, for example, were diverse religions. This is 1920s Palestine. This woman in the white hat, by the way, was a Protestant woman. There was a Catholic woman there, a Muslim woman, some of various conservatism, if you want. But it turned out, actually, when they investigated this picture, the two women here with the full veil were doing it as a prop. They were going to meet with the High Commissioner. They entered into the High Commissioner office, of course, and he had his wife there, and this is a British soldier when they were meeting with him, and they said, "We are here to object about the Balfour Declaration, about the British occupation, about the Zionist plans in Palestine." He said, "Okay, would you have tea?" And they said, "No, we don't take teas from our enemies." And then these two women suddenly lifted the veils and looked straight at the High Commissioner. I said, "We want you to see our eyes and see how serious we are." It was just a prop, you know. But anyways, this is a group of religious leaders in Palestine, 1932. And they were gathered to do the same thing, to object to the Balfour Declaration and object to the British occupation of Palestine. This is Matia Mughannam again, the same woman who was head of the Women Union in the 1920s. She wrote a book eventually called The Arab Woman and the Palestine Problem, published in 1936. She would be like the Mahatma Gandhi or Martin Luther King of Palestine, I think, in retrospect. People will look at her in such a value. But anyway, you can tell from the faces of these people and from their religions the diversity that existed in our society. You know, this is an Ethiopian, for example. The Ethiopians came to Palestine and they integrated and became part of a society. The Armenians came to Palestine after the Armenian Holocaust, etc. And by the way, the use of the word Holocaust was done first for the Armenians. And they came and they integrated. We even have a quarter of the old city of Jerusalem called the Armenian Quarter. What's that about? You know, you give immigrants a quarter of your capital. Imagine Trump giving a quarter of Washington, D.C. to immigrants. but anyways, he should, I think, but that's another story. And of course, I paid the price for this, speaking out against the Balfour Declaration and the British occupation. And here's four Muslim leaders and two Christian leaders in British jails. And when these girls, who are diverse, Christian and Muslim, of diverse backgrounds, some Armenian, some etc., go to school in Jerusalem, in Bethlehem, as you see, this is a form of resistance. And I'll show just some pictures of resistance here quickly, but that's not the subject of my talk, so I'm just going to flip through these various forms of resistance. Well, maybe I'll stop at this slide, because this is the price you pay for resistance. Since 1948, over 100,000 Palestinian natives have been killed. Over 800,000 have been injured. Over 700,000 have been detained and imprisoned, including myself. And in the last few weeks, as you know, with the marches on the Gaza border, many more were killed, 140 so far, who lost their lives in the past 8 weeks. And over 10,000 who were injured in Gaza. But these are pictures of some of the people who lost their lives, including a medic, Razan Najjar, including a person who had lost his legs already in 2014, who was also targeted and killed with snipers. And children like this one who was shot in his back, even a baby, 8-month-old, who died from inhaling tear gas at a demonstration. Press people were shot, etc. Yesterday, actually, in the midday, we had a demonstration in Connecticut at Fairfield, where you are from, where we demonstrated in front of the Sturm and Roger company that manufactures sniper guns and sells them to Israel. Not only that, but Israel also loads their sniper guns with special bullets that do maximum damage, like these what's called butterfly bullets that kind of expand and destroy a lot of the flesh as they go through it, and the bones and everything else. And so many Palestinians have lost their limbs. In Gaza, actually, there's not enough medical services. There are certainly no prosthetics and things like that for people who lost their limbs. And, you know, I saw the picture of Ahd here. Ahd Tamimi, as you know, is a Palestinian girl who's now in an Israeli jail. I knew her and her family for the past 15 years, actually. And Ahd, I know she was resisting when she was 8 and a half or 9 years old, non-violently, you know. She slapped a soldier, and that's why she's in jail now, and her mother is in jail with her. Her mother is charged with posting things on Facebook, including the video of her slapping the soldier, of her daughter slapping the soldier. But also her brother, whom you see in the picture there, is also now in the Israeli jail. And two of her cousins are in Israeli jails. And she lost two uncles who were killed by the Israelis. The family is just an amazing family. I think everybody who goes to Palestine should go to Nabi Saleh and meet with the Tamimi family. This is a girl, her name is Emily Hankowicz. She's an American Jewish girl who came. Actually, when she first came to see me, she said, my family is Zionist and I support Israel. Do you have any problem with that? I said, no, you're welcome. I can talk to anybody. I don't mind, you know, it's whatever. So we talked, of course, and she wanted to find out what was going on. I told her to be careful, of course, but she chose to go to a demonstration, and she was shot in the eye. Unfortunately, she lost her eye, and she is, ironically, she's a visual artist, and all she was doing in that demonstration was sketching. I've seen her book with the pencil drawings of the demonstrations and things like that. But anyway, since then, she and her family have become anti-Zionist because Israel said, just like they did with Rachel Corrie, whom you know was killed, I said, well, you chose to be in a war zone. What war zone? There's people demonstrating under military occupation. This is not a war. This is a military occupation. People are demonstrating. They have a right to demonstrate. So anyways, this is Rachel Corrie, by the way, when she was killed. She came to my village of Beit Sahur, actually, where we trained her in nonviolent resistance, and she went to Rafah, where she was killed. This is a friend of mine, Basim Abu Rahma, who was killed by tear gas that crushed his heart, a canister. And then I went to his funeral, and a month later I also went to his house. His sister Jawahar actually showed me the room which they have kept the same way. But unfortunately, she herself was killed by inhaling tear gas at the same demonstration. This is me being arrested a few times. You see my t-shirt there? Got human rights, Palestinians don't. And I'm grateful for this soldier who gave me this excellent photograph to prove I am right. Anyway, this is the last friend of mine that I lost in the struggle, Basil Laraj, who's from a village called Al-Walaja. And I have so many friends in Al-Walaja. Al-Walaja is like my second village, I consider it, because I go there all the time. And Al-Walaja is besieged, and there's a wall being built around it. Settlements have taken most of its land and all of its springs, basically, water. And here, Basil and I are in front of an Israeli bus stop. We called it actually Palestine Freedom Riders because we were trying to show how Israel is an apartheid state. I, as a Palestinian, even with my American passport, I'm not allowed into Jerusalem. Whereas any Jew in the world, including converts to Judaism, can come to Bethlehem, live on stolen Palestinian land with government subsidy and freely move around anywhere they want to, including go to Jerusalem or use the airport in Tel Aviv or whatever. By the way, that airport is also stolen from us. I don't know if you know that or not. It was called Lud Airport. It was built by Palestinians in the 1930s. Against the wishes, by the way, of the British government, which ruled Palestine at that time. They really started building it and pressured the British government to allow it to be built. And then Israel was created in 1948, and they took over that airport. They renamed it Tel Aviv Airport, and then they expanded it and renamed it Ben-Gurion Airport later when Ben-Gurion was dead. And you know about BDS. I'm not going to talk about BDS. Okay, so we talked about the patient history very briefly. We talked about the diagnosis, which is just one word, colonialism. We talked about the prognosis, which is pretty good. And we talked a little bit about the resistance, which is a form of therapy, right? So this is the big picture, if you want. What's the small picture which Annabelle and others are familiar with, those of you who came and visited with us, is that we are trying to build a center in Bethlehem which will be like an oasis of resistance, if you want, in the middle of this mayhem of power and politics and violence and all of this. It's an oasis that brings people and tell them what? Tell them that you have it within you to really do whatever you want in your life. So we bring children in, and the motto of the museum is respect. Respect for ourselves. As Palestinians, we can change our own circumstances, and respect for others, regardless of their religion or background or where they come from or ideology, even if they are Zionist. As I said, you know, I had even 55 Israelis come. They're welcome. They can hear and they can maybe change their mind. And if they don't, God bless them, let them do what they want. But it's a dead end road, as I explained to them. It's not going anywhere. So that's respect for others. And then respect for nature, animals and plants that are around us and how we do it. And the museum focuses on research, education, and conservation. Research is number one because we need to research our environment to be able to do proper education, etc. I like this image. I don't know where I stole it from, so excuse me. It was off the internet somewhere and I lost track and I can't find it anymore to give credit to whoever made it. But I like it. It's kind of symbolized what I really believe we do. And those of you on my email list, by the way, know that I end my emails with "Stay Human." Because that also I stole from another person. This time I know who I stole it from. It was Vittorio Arrigoni, an Italian activist. But anyways, and I don't know where Vittorio got it from. I'm sure he got it from somebody else. But anyways, that's a good idea about meme. It's like, also I showed you that the shrinking map of Palestine was invented by my son. But don't worry, no copyright. Use it freely. You don't have to say who originally. Good idea, spread it, doesn't matter. So, becoming more human is a central part of it. And what do we mean by that? Here, we have to understand that when Mr. Linnaeus named us Homo sapiens, he had wishful thinking, you know? And maybe someday we will reach that name that was given to us, to our species. But, you know, we have to work on it, and we have to work on it every day, and I think it's not an easy job. So becoming more, that's why I like this figure. It doesn't say stay human or whatever. It says becoming more human, becoming more rational, more logical, more whatever. But also recognizing that humans, what distinguishes us from all the other creatures on Earth is this brain that had a straight line of size that kept growing year after year, decade after decade, million of year after million of year. And this brain is important. We cannot ignore it, so we have to use it. And that to me is, and most people don't use it, unfortunately. You see Donald Trump do this movement mocking the... I mean, I couldn't believe it when I saw that, mocking the handicapped person. You know, what does he have a brain? I don't know. It's very strange, you know. But this is the, you know, this is, in my opinion, something we all have to work on, not just Donald Trump. Me too. Okay, everybody has to work on it. And every day I wake up to say, hey, what can I do better? Where can I... you know, have more joy, more creativity, more community involvement. This to me is very important. More hope, by the way. Hope is very, very important. Maybe it should have a bigger slice of that pie. Because without hope, how are we going to do things? Action here is a big part. And that girl, Razan Najjar, who was 21 years old, the medic who was shot, by the way, on her Facebook page, it was... brilliant woman, on her Facebook page, the last entry, or next to the last entry, was an entry that says, I'm writing to those who keep criticizing us for going in the front line, for doing these things. I tell them, you will never understand unless you actually come down with us and see what we do, and act with us. And then, just one day, and then you will understand why we put our lives on the line. And I thought about it. What does she mean by it? She means that action is actually what leads you to better understanding, right? And Basil Large, by the way, in his little insert that he put in a book, that was like a will, people consider it a will, but it was just more of a, you know, kind of his thoughts. He said, you know, the reason the thought was a will is because the way he wrote it. He said, I looked at what martyrs have written before they died, their will and etc. And I found that they're usually very pithy, few lines with no substance, no. And I was thinking, why do they do that? Why don't they write something profound that illuminates for us the way and whatever? And then it dawned on me that their actions is much more than any words could ever articulate. And that's it. So people thought that what he meant is he's going to go and do something that will result in his death. But I don't think so. I think it's just a random thought. He had a lot of these random thoughts. I even have some of them saved. Okay, so in my point of view that I want to illustrate is, what is the role of us humans in nature? Is it the role of us, like the Israelis did here when they drained what they called the swamp of the Hula, which is the wetlands, which many migratory birds pass through, and they drained it and supposedly to make it green and develop this, and in the process caused 119 species to disappear? Or when they maliciously diverted the waters of the Jordan Valley to create supposedly the Israel water carrier that deprived the Jordan Valley of water and resulted in desertification of the Jordan Valley and also the shrinking of the Dead Sea, which now supposedly they're going to fix the shrinking of the Dead Sea with this Dead Sea Red Sea canal, which adds $15 billion to the debt of the government of Jordan. And it's a horrible, horrible idea, by the way, to do this canal between the Red Sea and the Dead Sea. I don't have time to explain the ramifications of this. Is that the role of humans on this earth? Is the role of humans to continue to dump carbon dioxide and liberate the carbon from its stores into the air, creating global warming, and in our case that will result in 2 to 4 degrees increase in temperature in Palestine and decrease in rainfall by 20-25%. Is our role to take a hill like this, like the Israelis have done in 1997, including land from my own relatives, by the way, in Beit Sahur, and take it? They used to go there to study nature, catch butterflies, collect snails, and etc. And to make it into this concrete jungle. Is this the role of humans on Earth? Is it to dump our toxic waste on other people because they are not God's chosen people? Israel puts its most polluting industries in the West Bank, which cause genotoxic effects for our population. We studied this with my master's students. Is it to do this, to take water from one people and give it to immigrants? 91% of the water of the West Bank is taken by Israel, causing us severe problems with water. If they distribute it equally, by the way, there's plenty of water, but they are not going to distribute it equally. Or is it to coop people up like they did in Gaza, 2 million people in this open-air prison that, because of the gas fields that they want in Gaza? So that these 2.5 million people, soon, by the way, there'll be 2.5 million people. These people will literally starve and have problems. What is it, or is our role to respect this diversity of animals and plants around us, which we study at the museum and we publish papers like this one? This is Muhammad Abu Sirhan, who's actually an undergraduate student, and he published this paper when he was a freshman in college in biology. And the second year, he published another paper on the grasshoppers of the West Bank. And now he's in Italy, by the way, finished his bachelor degree early, and now he's going to finish master's degree in Italy. This is the diversity that exists in our region. It's very rich diversity, and if we don't do something now as we speak, it really doesn't matter if scenario one, scenario two, or scenario three of colonialism materializes. Because all three, if we don't protect our nature, we'll end up with a catastrophe on us. Okay? I told you I prefer scenario three, and I think that's what's going to happen. But we can't wait for that to happen. I cannot wait another 20 years, or 10 years for that matter, before we start thinking about the environment and how we can protect the environment. So that's why I feel the urgency. That's why we publish research papers on these things. We go to the field, we study them, we do experiments in our museum in the garden, for example, like aquaponics, growing fish and vegetables in the same system, or teaching our children the value of looking and observing and developing critical thinking. Chinese have a saying, I hear and I forget, I see and I remember, I do and I understand. So the idea is for them to touch things, feel things, and this way they can understand more of value of these things. So the girls, for example, here were engaged in recycling trash to produce gifts from it, or recycling paper and things like that, or touching and feeling and observing and enjoying these processes. Here we even have the kindergarten kids dress as butterflies to really think what does a butterfly need in order to survive. We take them on the field to teach them to love Palestine, love land, and protect the land. So we have the t-shirt here says respect for the environment is respect for ourselves. You see the little American flag on the t-shirt on the front? This project was funded by the U.S. consulate. I hope they are not regretting it now. But anyway, no, I was honest with them. I said, what I'm doing is teaching children to love the land, and to me this is a form of resistance. I wrote this in the proposal. I was surprised that they funded it, but anyways. And we get a lot of internationals, as you heard, come and stay with us, eat with us, enjoy themselves. We have opened the museum to the public in April 2017. We hope to open the botanical garden in 2019, and we hope to open the green building in 2021. I already secured funding for the garden, so that's on track. I'm working now on funding for the green building, and I actually managed to get $400,000 for that. Hooray! And I need another $600,000, so if one of you has a rich uncle, please let me know. But anyways, now here where I kind of sum up, my old professor at the university in Texas Tech, who died recently, unfortunately, Robert Baker, used to tell me, when you give talks, you should tell people what you are planning to tell them, and then you should tell them, and then in the end, tell them again what you just told them. That way they will remember. But anyways, the bottom line message, and he said something else which I always remember. He said, somebody comes and wakes up one of the audience people at 2 o'clock in the morning and asks them, what did this guy tell you? They should be able to say in one sentence something that's relevant, that's a key point that this person wants to give. So my key point is this. The colors of the Palestinian flag are multiple colors. Black, red, white, green. And by the way, the tables here, when we ate dinner, they had those four colors on them. My favorite color is none of these. My favorite color is blue, by the way. But would I want to have my garden full of blue flowers? It would be boring, I love a blue flower when it's surrounded by other colors that give it highlight, that give it strength, that make it make sense, So diversity, again, is strength. And I emphasize this point more than anything else, is that I really believe that we have to rethink society's structure and respect for the other and inclusion of the other and having pluralistic societies. And for those who support the one religion or the one skin color or the one this or the one that, I'm sorry to break it to them, but history has moved on, you know? And these things don't last. I mean, the Nazis lasted in power 12 years. South Africa lasted with apartheid, trying to maintain blacks separate from whites for, 130 years or something, which is long. The Crusaders lasted 120, 130 years. That's another reason why I'm optimistic, because we in Palestine are also about that age. So this cannot last much longer. So I really encourage us to rethink our positions and what we fight for and how we fight for it. And we have to do it, in my humble opinion, in a way that keeps the doors of the tent open, so to speak, even for those who oppose us. I can tell you stories about this because I did succeed even in converting some Zionists to come our way. And we can talk about that if you want. But that's the bottom line of my message, if you want. And if somebody wakes you up at 2 in the morning, please tell them diversity. One word. Thank you.
You have been listening to Mazen Kumsiya, human rights activist first and foremost, but also professor of genetics and founder of the Palestine Natural History Museum at Bethlehem University. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at wzbc.org. We thank you for your time, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday for another edition of This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts, wishing you a good morning.